We'll call the House Tax Committee to order. We are not quite at a quorum yet, but we will start with our bills. And members, just so I'm trying to accommodate members' schedules here, so we're going to start off with 1447. We will then go to 1378, Representative Dean, and then we'll go to 858, and then we will go to 786. And we need to be flexible because I want to get through these bills, and I want to give the department as much time. I mean, we'll give them full, free, and fair hearings, of course. But when we're done, then we are going to take the 1694 Anderson bill. The department has a presentation they'd like to make regarding the Chair Anderson S bill. Okay, so with that, I will move House File 1447 for Representative Franzen, and I see no amendments here. So, Representative Franzen, welcome to the Tax Committee and to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 1447 is the reintroduction of the same bill I authored in 2015 and 2016 legislative sessions. The bill would reinstate an allowance for the state's tobacco wholesalers that affix tax stamps to each pack of cigarettes sold in Minnesota. One of these wholesalers' companies is Henry's Foods in Alexandria, the city that is easy to get to and hard to leave. And I have here with me today Dale Erickson of Henry's Foods, who will explain the significant out-of-cost pockets his company incurs to stamp cigarettes for the state of Minnesota. By the way of background, Minnesota law requires the wholesalers affix a stamp to each pack of cigarettes as proof that the cigarette tax has been paid. For decades, the state provided an allowance to cigarette wholesalers to reimburse them for the cost to stamp cigarettes. However, the stamping allowance was repealed in 2003 as part of an overall budget balancing measure. Minnesota and New Hampshire are the only two states that do not provide a stamping allowance, while the other 48 states help cover the cost of stamping by giving an allowance to cigarette wholesalers. House File 1447 would provide for a 0.3% allowance, which would equal 9-tenths of 1 cent per stamp tax stamp. So, with the current cigarette tax at $3.04 a pack, the bill allows a wholesaler less than a penny per tax stamp to cover costs. Now, the state does provide a similar allowance called a commission to retailers that sell lottery tickets that equal 6 cents per ticket sold. Also, the state provides the lottery machines and tickets free of charge to all retailers. In fiscal year 2016, the lottery retailers have paid commissions of, get this, $35.7 million and brought in a whopping $144 million to the state of Minnesota.
Wow.
In contrast, wholesalers remitted $477 million in cigarette tax stamp to the state in fiscal year 2016 while requiring cigarette wholesalers to buy their own stamping machines and pay for all the costs to operate and maintain the machines. The fiscal note for House File 1447 calculates the 0.3 stamping allowance to be about 2.7 for a biennium. That's million. I believe that a cigarette tax stamping allowance needs to be reinstated to treat our wholesalers fairly so they can recoup some or all of the costs in stamping cigarettes. And now I will allow Mr. Dale Erickson to proceed with his testimony, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Franzen, I will allow him to provide testimony. please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Dale Erickson. I represent Henry's Foods in Alexandria, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you.
And it is hard to leave Alexandria.
It is. Yeah. I left this morning, but I'm going back.
Okay. To the bill, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dale Erickson, and I'm the general manager of Henry's Foods, a wholesale distribution company located in Alexandria, Minnesota, that sells snacks, beverages, candy, food items, and tobacco products to retailers. We brought our concerns about the need to reinstate a wholesale cigarette stamping allowance to Representative Franzen, and we would appreciate your support for this bill. As Representative Franzen indicated, wholesalers incur significant costs to comply with the state's requirements that cigarette stamps be affixed to each pack of cigarettes. While each wholesaler's cost will vary, Henry's Foods incurs the following cost to stamp cigarettes. We purchased our cigarette stamping machine for $90,000. To ensure that we can keep the machine running, we stock about $10,000 worth of parts in our warehouse. We also pay $3,100 a year to the machine manufacturer for a maintenance and service contract to cover service calls and repairs to the stamping machine.
How, sir, how much?
We $3,100 a year to the manufacturer of the machine.
Okay.
In addition, we have two full-time employees whose jobs include stamping cigarettes every day that we're working, which is 4 days a week that they stamp, and their wages and benefits add up to $54,080 per year. The software to make the machine operate was $34,000. We also pay an annual software support fee of $8,000. We also have warehouse space dedicated to the stamping machine and incur utility costs to operate the machine. Finally, we also reimburse the state for the cost of printing the tax stamps. This is very unfair as no other state charges wholesalers for the cost to actually print the tax stamps. In short, Henry's Foods has paid out $90,000 to buy our machine to stamp the cigarettes. And we spend another $109,180 a year to operate and maintain the machine to stamp cigarettes for the state of Minnesota. On behalf of all the wholesalers in Minnesota, we are only asking that we be reimbursed for the cost we incur to stamp cigarettes for the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And Rifkin Franz, and you've done a lot of work on this over the years, and you've done a very good job on this. Well, Franz and David. I might have a chance. Okay. So with that, is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns thereof? I see we have Mr. Bryant as a resource if needed. Let's go to member questions on House File 1447, Representative Metsa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Franz, and not really any questions. It seems kind of like a fair request to me as well. And as someone who quit a few weeks ago now,
congratulations.
I see it only fair as I'm not contributing to any profit margin anymore to support the bill in committee today.
Okay. Well, there you go. We do have a quorum. I'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order. I will move the Franzen Bill, House File 1447. More of any other questions from members? We've seen this, the last 3 years you worked on this? Okay. So I think we kind of understand what we're trying to do here. So with that, I will move House File 1447, be later for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. And Representative Franzen, thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And represent the best.
Okay.
Dale right here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Safe trip back to Alexandria, home of, I believe, the Cardinals.
Alexandria Cardinals.
Cardinals. Go Cardinals.
State girls basketball tournament right now.
Oh, okay. Good luck to you. Let's play somebody from the Southeast. Okay. Representative Dean is here. Representative Dean, you know, to help staff here a little bit, I'm going to break from tradition. I'll probably be hearing about it next week. But Representative Lesh moves the minutes of March 9th, 2017, and I know it's kind of out of order, yes, sir. Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. This is to help our staff get things up to date in the book here. Representative Metsa moves the minutes of March 14, 2017. Any additions or corrections?
Also early reviewed.
Thank you for that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next week, we will get back to tradition. Okay, so with that, let's go to, I will move House File 1378, members. Representative Dean R's bill, and there is an H2 amendment. Representative Dean, is that your amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
So I'll move House File 1378. I will move H13782 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Chair Erickson. Okay, so we have the bill as amended. A two-year bill, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're back again. We've been here before. This is one of those projects that's gotten caught up in our process that hasn't allowed it to be funded in a way that I believe it should. It's a project that rehabilitated an old library in my district, and it's a unique library, and it's currently being used for a job training center for individuals in the community. And I'd actually like to turn it over to Mike Blinn to testify. He's the CEO of Emerge, which houses, which programs are housed in there. We got a little PowerPoint. I don't know if we've been able to get it up, though.
Looks like we're going to need to just do both.
Well, thank you, Christine. Before we get going with the witness, is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill? Does Mr. Kelleher wish to testify? Or Okay, so after this testimony, we'll go to you, sir. Anyone else wish to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns thereof? Okay, so the department. Does the department wish to weigh in? Of course, they can weigh in on any of these bills anytime they'd like. So, and again, Mr. Cummings is over in the Senate. I was quite hurt by that he would pick them over us today, but that's the way it goes. We're very well represented from the department when we get to that bill. So, with that being said, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Wynn, President and CEO of Emerge.
Could you spell your last name, please?
W-Y-N-N-E.
Thank you, sir. To your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a one-pager here in lieu of the PowerPoint that I hope has circulated.
Do we have that? If a page could pass that off, please.
I think he wanted to check on the PowerPoint.
Oh, okay.
So we'll have to
all
pass
right.
it out.
Well, we'll fly her blind right now. You tell us what's on.
I'll point.
Okay, point. The PowerPoint.
Well, in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'll move forward. So our organization, Emerge, as Representative Dean has described, took on as part of our commitment to North Minneapolis, the redevelopment of the historic North Branch Library. It is a nationally significant historic building, and we've successfully repurposed it into a career, modernized career technology center. Our organization was able to raise $6.5 million in diversified public and private capital to successfully complete the renovation and put the building back into service in early 2015. The project experienced many challenges, and the most significant was that we moved toward closing down the construction. We were deemed ineligible for state historic tax credit program due to a technical glitch that caused us to forfeit $880,000 due to a structural incompatibility with federal funding that we received, $2.6 million U.S. Economic Development Administration grant. The loss of the $880,000 provided a gap in funding that we caused us to have to seek loans from city and county government sources. We previously had an appropriation at this level approved by committee, but it did not proceed with stalled bills in the last two sessions. But a little bit about the history. It looks like we're live here. And I'll just take you through real quickly. It's the state's oldest library building. It was built in 1894, and it is nationally significant in that it was considered the first open-shelf library in the United States and the first branch in the Minneapolis system. It was nominated in 1977. We've been able to complete and put back into service. We've renewed it as a job training center, providing community technology, computer literacy, and digital job skills, as well as a number of different career path services that have successfully gotten underway here in the last year. Project was diversely funded, city, county, legacy grants, private dollars, and federal EDA dollars. And however, this we highlight this dilemma that we had the federal requirement required us to have a nonprofit structure to receive the grant, and the historic credit required us to create a for-profit tax credit structure, and there was an incompatibility with the state program. Our request is to allow Emerge to receive a tax credit at the level that we would have received, equal to the amount that would have been available through the state historic rehabilitation tax credit. Without the credit, we continue to be challenged to support the operating costs of the debt service on the loans, and it will certainly inhibit our ability going forward to provide training programs and services to people. This is about jobs. We were able to create 75 construction jobs. We are on track to serve approximately 3,000 people annually at the center, with 300 people engaged in career training in manufacturing and a variety of other career areas, and it all lends to a total caliber of 800 jobs that we're generating through our programs each year. Spotlight on our career training. We have an on-site relationship with Hennepin Technical College, where they're providing a manufacturing advancement and assessment center, a machinist training lab. We also have two other digital literacy and training classrooms and a variety of training partnerships. And last year, 395 people attended career training in 2006 at the center, and 123 have achieved occupational skills thus far. We have had a very broad base of support, as I said earlier, listing of the funders involved and a variety of sources. And just a few more pictures of the building. It's a majestic red brick building. And it was abandoned when we got a hold of it, and we've been able to turn it into really quite beautiful spaces for the community and for the operations of these programs.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Questions for Mr. Wynn? Representative Lesh. Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for one of the smart people.
Yeah, I'm ready.
There's a constitutional prohibition against special legislation, and Article 12, and I know we do this kind of thing all the time, I think, around here, but I'm trying to recall why when there's a bill that issues parameters that apply to only one project, which I think this is, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
I know that we've done this before, so I know we can do it, but I can't understand why we can do it when the Constitution prohibits it. Is there anyone who can answer that?
Mr. Michael? All of a sudden, I'm not feeling so smart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, yes, the Constitution does have prohibitions on special laws that prohibit enacting legislation that, other than, you know, special laws relating to local governments. And so in order to survive a challenge, if there's a challenge, you would have to craft it as a general law that likely would apply to only one entity. The reality is that this, to the extent that it applies to only one entity, is written, you know, arguably as a general law. It's not open-ended. The practical reality is that no one is likely to have standing to challenge it, and no one will challenge it. And so this is kind of a law school exam question as opposed to a practical reality.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was an excellent answer. Appreciate that.
Okay, any other questions at this point? Representative Petersburg, then Mr. Keller, if you can come down and take a seat, please.
Mr. Chair, also just remember, tax committee has no rules.
With the tax committee, can do whatever he wants. Okay. We'll see if it stands up in court, but okay. Please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few quick words. We've heard this bill before, and I've testified, and I'll say what I said before. We administer the State Historic Tax Credit Program in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and that's why we're here. I would say, first of all, this is a really, really good historic preservation project. It's a really good community development project, and this is the kind of thing that we want to see. We want to see buildings reused and be part of the life of the community. Our concern, however, is that this falls outside of the existing historic preservation tax credit program that you all set up in law 6 or 7 years ago, and really creates a precedent by which others could come in and if they don't qualify for the state and federal tax credit program, and that's how the law is written, that you must qualify for both, that you could come in and get a special exception, and that does not help with streamlining of the process and setting up criteria that is simple and understandable and fair to others who use the program. This committee has considered other alternatives to help out the project accomplish their goals and make their budget, and I think some of those options that have been considered in the past were win-win opportunities that satisfied everyone, and I hope you consider some of those opportunities again, and we would be very much supportive of some alternatives to this specific approach.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Kelleher? Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelleher, could you give us one example of an alternative that has already been used?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, an alternative would be to provide a grant to this project that allows them to complete their project and complete their budget without carving out an exemption in the tax law system.
Chair Erickson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for members? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you pursued legacy funding for this project yet this biennium?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wills, the project did receive a legacy grant of 4% when it was going through the initial phase of pulling together the money for the project. So it has received legacy grant. And I don't believe that at this stage of the project it could actually receive legacy grants. Okay.
Representative Wills.
Thank you.
Questions for members? Okay, with that, anyone else wish to testify on behalf of or with concerns? Department? Okay. I will renew my motion to lay over House File 1378 as amended. Thank you, Representative Dean, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Item next, and members, just to kind of keep score here, I'm going to hold the 1694, the answer bill, till the end so that we can spend as much time as we can on it. Let's go to House File 858, Representative Johnson. And then there's three very quick David's bills, and then we will have the department, or we'll have Chair Anderson present her bill. Okay, I will move House File 858. It will be for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I see no amendments, members. So I'll move House File 858. Representative Johnson, welcome to Tax Committee. To your bill, sir.
Mr. Chair, it's a privilege to be in front of this prestigious Tax Committee. This bill is actually a reduction in registration fees for unmanned aircraft. Currently, aircraft valued under $500,000 is a $100 yearly fee. Right now, there's no statutes dealing with the unmanned aerial aircraft. And this bill actually gives them a definition, sets the registration fees instead of $100 to $25 for those unmanned aircraft that are 55 pounds and less that are used in commercial business. Today I have with me Eric Rudin of MnDOT, who's going to explain the bill. This is a department bill.
Okay, thank you. First of all, before we hear from the witness, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? I don't have anybody else, but you're certainly welcome. Anyone with concerns? The department, I guess we'll hear from the DOT. Department of Revenue, of course, can give testimony anytime they'd like on any bill. So with that being said, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill, as Representative Johnson indicated, actually would result in a reduction in the annual registration for unmanned aircraft from $100 per year to $25 per year. The bill also specifically exempts drones that are used for recreational purposes. There's no such exemption in current law, but we feel it's important to provide that exemption. So That is the bill, Mr. Chair. The sections 1 and 2 are simply definitions. Section 3 of the bill is the requirement for drones less than 55 pounds to be registered for the annual fee of $25, and provides that specific exemption for drones operated for recreational purposes. Section 4 is language about tax refunds for aircraft that are registered, and provides that these are not eligible for a tax refund if they're destroyed. And then Section 5 provides a mechanism if a person has registered at the higher $100 registration already, it provides a mechanism for us to provide a refund to those people so that they can receive the difference between the $100 registration and the $25 registration.
Okay, questions for members to the witness? Rosa Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got some constituents of mine that actually do some recreational photos, in particular of the Highway 53 bridge recently that's been used to update the community on the progress. And they've shared some of the concerns about the fees. And would this apply to, say, someone using it for photography purposes as well, if they were selling the photos or licensing?
Mr. Rudin?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, that would be required to be registered, since that would be for a commercial purpose if they're selling those photos, yes.
Representative Metza?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there other permitting required then to go out and take photos when that is the case?
Mr. Rudin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Metza, they are also required to be registered with the Federal Aviation Administration. So there would be that registration process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this would still require everyone the burden of having two processes to go through, when my understanding is the Federal Aviation has a higher jurisdiction over that airspace.
Mr. Rudin?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And we've been exploring with the FAA if there's a way to coordinate those registrations. So far, the FAA has not been willing to share the information that they receive with states. So until that changes, there would need to be this two-tiered registration process.
Thank you, Mr. I guess I just wonder why, if it's being regulated by the federal government, we're regulating it all here in Minnesota and making someone who's taking pictures in my constituent's case go through a double process to have a business that's, you know, essentially being regulated by the federal government, who's not even talking with our state government about it. So I guess if you could just keep my office updated on what we're doing here. I do support reducing the fee, but would support more eliminating the fee in the process.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza. Right now, my understanding of the FAA was even a recreational use drone needs to be registered with the FAA. This deals with just commercial use, so people using them for business.
That's it.
Steve Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I know, Representative Johnson, if you know this, but law enforcement is using drones. How do they fall under this? Do they register and have to pay a fee, or how would law enforcement?
Representative Johnson.
Myself, I'm not sure. Maybe Mr. Rudin could answer that.
Mr. Chair, but sorry, if we could have Ms. Isaacson from our Office of Aeronautics.
We have an Office of Aeronautics?
We do.
Oh, cool. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Cassandra Isaacson. I'm the Director of Aeronautics for MnDOT.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And yes, just like all other aircraft, they would be required to register their aircraft. So law enforcement, all government users would be required to register their aircraft.
Representative Marker.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions on this bill? Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 858 be later for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Johnson, and to the witnesses.
Thank you.
Okay, item next, we will go to House File 786. This is aid payments authorized to districts with maximum effort loan interest payments between December 1st, 97, June 30th, 16. And I believe something very similar to this was in House File Conference Report for 848. I think there's been a couple small changes. We have a couple superintendents here, and this, the way it is right now, as is amended out of Ed Finance, includes seven districts, I believe. I think we added Ogilvy, if I remember correctly. So this is my bill, and this is, as I said, this is the school district maximum effort loan, capital loan bill for property tax reductions. And I would like to start out with Superintendent of Caledonia Schools, Mr. Barton, if you could state your name as we represent the record.
Thank you very much, Chair Davids and committee. My name is Ben Barton. I am the superintendent of schools for the Caledonia Area Public School District. We are the home of the Warriors. So this bill has to do with the maximum effort capital loan. And I should point out to the committee that this bill was included in the tax bill that had bipartisan support last year that was vetoed. So we're bringing it back and hoping that we can get it passed this year. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about our story. In 2001, Caledonia Area Public Schools, we built a building, and it was funded through a maximum effort capital loan. Although I'm not an expert in maximum effort capital loans, there's a couple of things that I am aware of. One is it's a fairly unique funding stream, and two, it's the intent of it was so that school districts that had failing facilities, that had low property value, and had a difficult time passing a bond referendum, it was a funding mechanism for them. So we built our building in 2001. In 2011, there was some legislation that gave many school districts with a maximum effort capital loan the opportunity to pay off their loans by paying only the original principal amount of the loan and essentially forgiving all interest accumulated on the loan since inception. However, the law was restricted to loans that were authorized prior to 1997. Since Caledonia built our building in 2001, we were not part of that, and there was a handful of other districts that fell into that as well. Most of the districts that benefited from the 2011 law have paid little or no principal on the original loans and had accumulated a significant additional interest that added to the amount. This is directly related to ANTC. How the loan was structured is that the legislation called for 29.9% of ANTC to be collected in these districts. And since most of these districts have very low property value or assessed value, very little taxes were collected. Therefore, little to no taxes were paid back to the state. This brings us to the language that is in this bill that's being considered. We feel that this bill is a bill of fairness and equity. As previously stated, the majority of capital loan communities paid little to no principal or interest on their loan. However, a few districts, Caledonia included, paid millions to the state in principal and interest. This was due to the significant increase in our ag assessed value. Our ANTC went up significantly, and therefore our residents' taxes went up significantly because the terms of the loan required residents to be taxed at the 29% of ANTC. Essentially, our ag community in our area shouldered the burden of these significant tax increases. And as you know, that property assessed value does not equal the amount that our residents had in their bank account. This bill provides property tax credits equal to the interest each district paid back to the state. Only districts that paid down their interest to the state would benefit from this bill. We're simply looking for the same benefit that, many districts received in the bill that was passed in 2011. Again, we feel that this is about fairness and equity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Barton. I think we'll go to the next witness, Superintendent Andy Almos of East Central Schools. But before we do that, is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Okay, so we'll take the testimony and we'll go to member questions. Okay, Superintendent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Again, my name is Andy Almos, Superintendent of Schools, East Central, home of the Eagles, actually. I just wanted to, I won't go into the details similar to Mr. Barton, but our district is in a similar position. We received a $19 million capital loan from the state in 2001 as well. And in the last session, we took advantage of the refunding and the refinancing. And it's our understanding, it's the state's desire to sunset the capital loan program. And again, we're back with the second half of this was in the tax bill last session. So this is not money going obviously back to our school district, but it is a direct payment back to our taxpayers. So we are here on behalf of our school district taxpayers, and we're hopeful we can move forward with this. So,
and just so I'm stating this correctly, this affects the targets of the tax committee, not any other committee. Is that correct, Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael? I just want to get that on the record. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, please. You have to throw it at him. I just asked a simple question.
Just carrying a lot of bills around,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Analysis. Yes, this was part of the omnibus tax bill that was passed but not made into law last year. And we carried that in our spreadsheet, and with your desires, we would do that again. The revenue estimate, just so you know, has been revised. It more reflects the amounts that we carried last year, $2.9 million in fiscal 18 and then $3.15 million in 19, 20, and 21.
And thank you for that, Michelle. Members, you should have that dated March 15th of 17, the updated corrected numbers. Any questions for Michelle? Okay, let's go to questions from members. For Superintendent Barton or Superintendent Almos, the Warrior or the Eagle. Okay, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 786 be delivered for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Item next, 2022. Okay, I will move House File 2022. Members, this bill is the income tax sourcing rules for directors' compensation. And this is one, just to be very clear, I know that the department's like all over the Capitol complex today, but I want to be right up front that there are the commissioner, I talked to the commissioner and others, and they do want to continue to work on this bill. They're not, the department hasn't agreed to all of the language to this point, just to be very clear. Okay, so with that, where's my agenda sheet? Okay, so that's my bill. That's what we're doing. We have a Jill Larson, Dale Busacker. They would like to testify on this. Anybody else wish to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? The department? Okay, so please state your name who represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Jill Larson with Minnesota Business Partnership. Here to support Chair David's bill. I also want to let folks know that the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce also supports this bill, but in the interest of the committee's time, they will not be testifying. Pretty simple bill, Mr. Chairman. This is something that was before the committee a couple years ago. This proposal would actually eliminate the confusion that currently exists around the way Minnesota taxes the income of non-residents that happen to be board members of Minnesota-based companies. And the way that it works now is the Department of Revenue has a revenue notice that says that if a person serves on two or fewer boards, their income will be taxed based on their time spent in Minnesota. And all of this bill does would be to simply codify that revenue note and apply it also to board members who serve on three or more boards. So it would basically level the playing field. Regardless of the number of boards that you serve on, your income would be taxed based on the amount of time you spend in Minnesota. So it's pretty simple. concept. The reason why this is important for Minnesota is because the way that the impact that the current practice that the Department of Revenue has now, because there really isn't a rule about how they treat the income of people that are on three or more boards, is that it is causing Minnesota-based companies to not want to have their board meetings here because their directors may have more of their income taxed here than is appropriate. And so it is creating a disincentive for people to have board meetings here, which, of course, then prevents Minnesota from receiving the economic activity that will occur from those board meetings. So we have worked with the department on this in the past. We, of course, will continue to work with them. But we think this is just a way to kind of clarify and level the playing field. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And we will have member questions after we hear from the next witness. Please state your name and your reference directly, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Tax Committee, my name is Dale Busacher. I'm a director with Grant Thornton LLP. I'm not testifying today on behalf of any particular client or on behalf of Grant Thornton, but I'm testifying as a concerned practitioner. The provisions, as Ms. Larson mentioned, the provisions of House File 2022 would simply provide that non-residents who serve on the board of directors for a Minnesota-based company would determine the amount of their Minnesota income using the same time-spent method that the department allows some board members to use. The time-spent method is also the same method that is used to determine the amount of income that's sourced to Minnesota for non-resident executives and non-resident employees. Currently, as Ms. Larson mentioned, based on a revenue notice issued in 2014, the department allows non-resident board members who serve on one or two boards to use the time spent method to determine the amount of their Minnesota income. However, the department has issued no guidance on non-resident board members who serve on three or more boards to explain how they are to determine the amount of their Minnesota income. As a result, in the course of audits that have occurred, auditors have specifically looked only at the location of where the board meetings are held, so that if three out of the four board meetings are held in Minnesota, the auditor will assess the board member on 75% of their income from that board activity without any regard to the fact that the board member has spent a significant amount of time preparing for the board meeting. Auditors have even gone so far as to consider that a board member was to have earned income in Minnesota while they are physically outside of Minnesota, but they call into a board meeting that's occurring in Minnesota. As a result, I'm aware of boards that have decided to no longer hold board meetings in Minnesota because of this aggressive audit activity. This is not a healthy position for the future growth of jobs and investment activity in Minnesota. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I urge your support for House File 2022.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions from members? Okay, with that, I will move that House File 2022 be there for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, item next, and 1694 is, we want to give the department, and Chair Anderson asked as much time as they need on that bill. So the next bill is House File 2314. I'll move 2314. And I see no amendments. And this is the known as the moist snuff bill. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on behalf of the bill? How many people like to testify on behalf of the bill or with concerns on the bill? And the department? Okay, go ahead and have a seat, sir, and please testify for the bill. State your name and who you represent for the record. Well, Mr. Ines, do you want to join us here at the table?
My name is Ross Amundson from M. Amundson Cigar and Candy Company in Bloomington, Minnesota.
In where?
Bloomington.
Well, Bloomington. I think Lewiston. Okay. Okay. Welcome to the committee, sir, and to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ross Amundson. I'm a partner with my brother at M. Amundson Cigar and Candy Company in Bloomington. My company is a wholesaler of candy tobacco products. We We've been a family-owned business since 1938. I started working in the work of my parents' warehouse when I was about 7 years old. I'm here today because I'm very concerned about the major tax increase to lower-income Minnesotans who purchase these products that would occur if this bill became law. I think the best way to explain this bill would be I think the best way to explain why this bill would be a major tax increase is to show you these two products. This is a 1.2-ounce can of chewing tobacco that's taxed at $3.04 a can. This is a 14.4-ounce tub of moist chewing tobacco. Under the state law, it's taxed at 95% of the wholesale cost. So the tax rate is $9.70. Now under the bill, the tax on this 14-ounce tub would be $3 per 1.2 ounces of moist chewing tobacco, or $36.48, which is a $26.78 increase. We sell a lot of these tubs in independent retail stores throughout Minnesota. I know that increasing the tax to $36.48 for this tub will be so prohibitive that we will no longer be able to sell them. Alternative non-tax sources will be found by the consumers for these products, exactly what has happened with cigarettes, with us being surrounded by significantly lower tax dates. These tubs are not a new product. We've been selling them for at least 10 years or more. This is not a product that was introduced 3 years ago when the method of taxing moist stuff went to waste-based per can. With two or more manufacturer price increases per year, weight-based taxes do not keep up with inflation or price increases. With tobacco taxation, only cigarettes are taxed at a flat rate. With their identical size and packaging, it makes sense and can easily be administered. Except for the content, it is obvious that these two products are not similar. With Minnesota sales taxes also added to the retail price, shouldn't a over 100% plus tax be enough when the state has a $1.6 billion surplus? The legislature would quadruple the tax on these tubs of moist snuff, which would financially harm my business, my retail partners, and all those already overtaxed Minnesota that buy these value-priced products. I cannot urge you strongly enough not to pass this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Amundson or members? Thank you very much, sir. Our next witness is Mr. Ward Innes. If you just please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Innes, here on behalf of Altria Client Services and its affiliates. And I want to thank the chairman for proposing this legislation to fix what I think we all would agree was an unanticipated loophole that resulted from the 2013 tobacco tax increase. Mr. Amundson, I think, has done a pretty good job of explaining the issue and actually highlighting why we need to equalize the tax between these products. Because if you remember, it was a substantial tobacco tax increase in 2013. The cigarette tax was increased by about 50, and there was a corresponding tax on moist snuff. A new structure was put into place as part of that increase, and the structure was a combination of a minimum tax of $3.04, whatever the cigarette tax equivalent was, or 95% of the wholesale price, whichever was greater. And at that time, we all thought that the standard product we're all familiar with is a 1.2-ounce small can you put in the back of your pocket. And there wasn't a precise definition of what a consumer-sized can was. We didn't define that very precisely. So what we've seen, even though you're right, Mr. Amundson, this is not a new product that just came on the market in 2013, what we did see was an explosion in this category of product. And since 2013, we've seen over 700% explosion in the consumption of this product. And we have not experienced that explosion in any other state. So it can only have us conclude that is a function of tax policy that is driving the volume of this product. If you look at, based on the calculations that Mr. Amundson shared with us, and the average tax on the 1.2 ounce is $2.54 per ounce. For this large 12-can equivalent, the per-ounce tax is 66 cents per ounce versus $2.54. And I would argue this is exactly the same product. So is this tax policy should not be driven by the size of the packaging, how it's marketed. And so all we're asking with some Chair David's bill is that this would equalize the tax. It would keep in place the minimum floor for the 1.2 ounce, so that would be $3.04, and then it would impose a per ounce tax for any amount above the 1.2 ounces, thereby equalizing the tax on all the products, and every product, no matter what its size, would pay the exact same per ounce tax. We think that's fair. We think that's equitable. I can't think of any other tax that is so contingent on the volume of the product, when in fact it's exactly the same amount. So, Chairman, I want to thank you for closing what I think was very much an unanticipated loophole that we didn't think about back in 2013 and equalizing the tax on these similar situated products.
And just to correct the record, technically, Mr. Innes, it's not a loophole. They are abiding by the law as it is. It was maybe an oversight. We'll call it. So thank you very much, both gentlemen, for explaining what my bill does. And so questions, let's see, questions for Mr. Innes. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Innes, or the other testifier as well. I'm just curious, what is the retail price of both products that you showed there prior to the tax?
Mr. Innes, or Mr. Amundson?
The retail on this one is $22.99. This is one of his products.
And the other one?
How much was 1.2?
The other one is usually around $7 or $8. This is also one of his products.
Thank you.
I didn't know you had so many products, Mr. Innes. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I'm just, the reference, Mr. Chair, is just in regards to taxes. Oftentimes, it's based upon retail sales and a lot of other things. It just seems that the difference between taxing of the two and based upon retail price also is also varied, and it's not consistent with each other as well. So it's just a comment. Thank you.
So, Mr. Innes, if the 1.2 ounce is about, you said, $7-$8, something like that, and how much larger is the other one?
This is a 6-can equivalent, this is a 12-can equivalent.
How much does 12-can cost?
All I have is the wholesale price, approximately wholesale price.
Mr. Amundson?
The retail price is $22.99.
Oh, that's the big one.
Yep, that's the big one.
So it's 12 times the product, but it's 3 times the price, in effect, or within a few cents. Okay. Questions for members? With that, I will move that I will move House File 2314 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you to both gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Item last.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate today to have Chair Anderson S. before us with House File 1694 members. And I do not, is there an amendment? There is an author's amendment. I believe it's the author's amendment. Two? Just one? Okay, so Chair Anderson S. moves House File 1694. Chair Anderson S. moves H1694A1 amendment. Any discussion? It's an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 1694 as amendment to your bill. Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, members. This bill is asking the Department of Revenue to provide private letter ruling for entities that are seeking greater input so that they can comply with Minnesota tax law. In addition to that, this bill also contains language that would require the Department of Revenue to provide for dual audits, because what we found is an entity might be audited 1 year on one segment, and in the following year audited in another tax area. And so they are having to have pay for representation, and then just the time, the expense of it becomes quite a burden to have it happen 2 years in a row rather than having it happen all at once. I kind of compare it to getting all four wisdom teeth pulled at once rather than having one taken out 1 year and then another the following year and so forth. So get the pain over with and get it done. This bill also provides for greater consistency in assessments on sales tax. It eliminates the seesaw effect where if the Department of Revenue has one person that provides advice to an entity
that conflicts with later on advice that the department has. It provides for greater consistency in that because ultimately our goal is to have our citizens complying with tax law. It also provides for a reasonable cause. If there is a lack of clarity in the tax interpretation or also the advice that they provided in the past, it provides for limits on that as well, and limits on the assessments. And then the final couple of items that I want to highlight is it also allows the commissioner to decline to impose penalties. I call this the it's not you, it's me provision. I'm sure if the commissioner had this authority, she would have be able to utilize that in cases where a penalty doesn't apply and she's just having to do it because of what the law says. And then finally, we have some tax provisions, tax court provisions in here that Representative Driscoll had carried. That was part of the amendment in Section 7. Basically allows the tax court to require electronic filing. And then Section 8 allows for a tax court employees to provide representation in the future. So if those are the two provisions that you amended on the bill. And that's the bill as much as I can describe it, Mr. Chair, and I do have some testifiers that wish to speak to it as well.
Thank you. So let's go to testimony. I have on my list Mr. Chris Martin, Dale Busacker, Gino Fragnito. Is there anyone else which testifies in support of the bill? And then anybody with concerns? And then we'll have the department, of course, when we're done with the testifiers. Okay, then we'll have a member question. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Taxes Committee. My name is Chris Martin, and I'm a senior manager with Grant Thornton, LLP, an accounting firm, and a supporting member of the Minnesota CPA Society.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assist our business and individual clients on Minnesota and other state and local tax matters. I'm here to testify in support of Representative Anderson's bill, House File 1694, particularly Section 1, which would establish a private letter ruling program in Minnesota. Minnesota and Alaska are the only two states that do not allow taxpayers to request some form of letter ruling from their state tax authority. PLRs would provide guidance to all taxpayers where the law, regulations, and administrative guidance is silent or open to interpretation. In various industry surveys and discussions with the department, taxpayers and tax practitioners have shown a strong desire for more transparency and certainty in order to comply with the increasingly complex tax world, and a PLR program would help to accomplish this. PLRs published online would provide freely available guidance to all taxpayers. If one taxpayer is dealing with a particular issue, chances are that other taxpayers are as well. For example, small businesses and accountants trying to understand how to comply could view the PLRs online and have a sense regarding how the department views this issue before they file their tax returns. A private letter ruling program would also help to avert tax litigation. PLRs are a less costly method of providing guidance for both the department and the taxpayers versus time spent undergoing lengthy audits and appeals. And while PLRs may at times focus on the complex issues, these are the very issues that consume a disproportionate amount of time on audits and appeals. In our business, taxpayers frequently struggle with certain issues. One, how the department might interpret the classification of tangible personal property and real property in a sales tax context. Another one, we've also helped businesses as they struggle with how to apportion certain revenue in the Minnesota sales factor. These are just two examples where taxpayers would benefit from a private letter ruling program. When we assist our clients in understanding the tax rules of other states, the other states' published PLRs can be very useful. And out-of-state businesses that are accustomed to looking at their state's private letter rulings for assistance are often puzzled and frustrated by the lack of guidance that the Department of Revenue in Minnesota provides. A taxpayer requesting a private letter ruling proactively discloses its name and facts in order to receive direction on a particular transaction or fact pattern. The transparency that the taxpayer demonstrates shows a level of openness and a desire to comply with tax laws, which is always positive. And it gives the department more insight into the taxpayer's business and allows it to administer the tax laws more efficiently. The Department of Revenue does an excellent job of providing broad guidance to a wide range of taxpayers, and they've stated that they want to issue more revenue notices, which is commendable. However, revenue notices do not, and they're not intended to, address all possible contingencies and fact patterns. In addition, revenue notices may take many months to publish and draft versus the 90-day requirement in this bill for a private letter ruling program. Taxpayers who are contemplating a potential transaction or needing to file a return need more timely advice. Minnesota businesses, individual filers, and tax practitioners deserve robust guidance in order to ensure that taxpayers who are paying for Minnesota's future are well equipped to do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. I think we'll take all the testimony and come back for member questions. We want to make sure members have questions. And please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir. And then if Mr. Fragnito could maybe grab another chair down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Tax Committee. My name again is Dale Busacher. I'm a director with Grant Thornton LLP. I'm not testifying today on behalf of any particular client. I want to support the testimony that my colleague Chris Martin gave with regards to private letter rulings, but I want to focus my testimony on another section of the bill, and that is Section 3, which would provide an equitable limitation on assessing sales tax in certain situations. Let me provide you with a hypothetical fact pattern that takes place over a few years. A company is audited by the department for sales tax purposes. The taxability of a particular item or transaction is reviewed by the department's auditor, who determines that the company is correctly exempting this item or transaction from tax. Over the course of time, there may be even additional audits for later periods where different auditors also agree. Time passes and the company assumes that is properly collecting and remitting sales tax to the state. Then a different auditor audits a company and determines that in his or her opinion, the prior auditor made a mistake and that the item or transaction is subject to sales tax and issues an assessment. My experience as a practitioner has been that when the company appeals this assessment, the response from the department's appeals officer is, I can't help the fact that the prior auditor has made a mistake. For a company that's attempting to comply with the law and that's relying on the prior auditor's presumptively valid determination to now be told that the department won't abate the assessment for that period is inconsistent and unfair. It unnecessarily damages the trust that must exist between companies that are trying to do their best to collect and remit the tax to the state and the department. Now, I want to be clear that these are gray areas of the law, as witnessed by the fact that both auditors, prior auditors, and the company thought that they were doing and applying the law correctly. Section 3 of this bill provides a better answer. It simply says, department, notify the taxpayer that going forward, they should begin collecting and remitting the tax on that transaction or on that item and abate the assessment. It's a better way to treat taxpayers. I'm happy to answer any questions and I urge your support for this bill.
Okay, if both you gentlemen can't stick around, though, because we'll go to member questions and we have questions for you. Please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and we want to thank Representative Anderson for introducing this legislation to address a number of changes to tax administration that CPAs believe will increase compliance with state law, decrease the cost of complying, while also providing some additional clear guidance to taxpayers who may need this additional information. Taxpayers want to comply with the law, and the creation of a private letter ruling program would provide more clarity to comply with an increasingly ever-complex tax world. A private letter ruling program will also provide clear guidance in gray areas or where the law may be silent or open to interpretation. While the Department of Revenue does have their revenue notice program, and in many situations that guidance is adequate, the notices do serve a large set of taxpayers, but unfortunately, there are situations where tax law has become more complex and additional taxpayers are finding it increasingly difficult to get the guidance that they may need. Well, this is not an apples-to-apples comparison. Think about a medical analogy where a general practitioner can address most of the situations with a patient, but there are situations where you have more complex cases and a specialist is needed. So, too, is the case with a situation where you've got more complex tax situations. We further believe a private letter ruling program is less costly than litigation and could ensue over ambiguities. The Minnesota taxpayers deserve the firm guidance to make decisions about expanding and growing their business in Minnesota. Also, it's my understanding that 48 other states do have this along with the federal government, so if it works there, I think it can work here in Minnesota. In closing, Mr. Chair, Minnesotans do want to comply with the tax law, and anything you can do to make it easier is a benefit to all. This legislation would provide certainty to those individuals who need more clarity, and those individuals are willing to pay the additional cost to correctly comply with the state tax law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And thank you, Mr. Fragnito. Questions from members to any of the first three witnesses here in support of the bill? Lead Marquardt.
So, thank you very much. And to the first testifier, thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that these private letter rulings are done in every state but one or something like that. How much in scope are they? I mean, is it comparable to what we're seeing in language here, or is there differences in scope and thoroughness and so forth? Are we comparing apples to apples when you say almost every state, or are there different standards and so forth?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, it's an excellent question. There is a great deal of variety among the states in how they term the private letter ruling programs and how they structure them. They go by different terms and certainly go by different responsibilities for the department. The language here is very robust, I believe, and mirrors some other states that have very thorough private letter ruling programs that would allow taxpayers to request guidance that is binding on the department for that particular taxpayer on a variety of different tax issues, corporate income, individual income tax, sales tax. But that would also be published online with, of course, confidential and private data redacted, but published online that other taxpayers could view as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more questions. You mentioned that this probably then, what we see here in Representative Anderson's bill is a little more robust than most, probably more thorough and so forth. So what is the typical cost? I see here on 2.4, 2.5, they talk about the actual cost, but to a maximum of like $1,000. From your knowledge, what would be the average cost that the states would charge? Or maybe Representative Anderson would know this.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt. In looking over this with staff, many states don't charge anything at all for a private letter ruling. And North Carolina, the typical charge is around $500. So we've gone beyond that. So we're at $1,000. North Carolina, for example, has a $500 charge. But they also allow for a 90-day ruling. Then you have a little bit more. So we put it at $1,000 to accommodate the 90-day ruling piece of it. But like I said earlier, some states don't charge anything at all. And typically the charge is around $500, and so we're $500 above what the average would be.
Representative Anderson, you mentioned that in one line it said the schedule will recover the department's actual cost, but then you go and you put a maximum of $1,000. Why don't you just, I mean, some letter rulings might be more intense labor-wise versus others. Why are you setting a limit at $1,000 if, in fact, your intent and the sentence before that is to recover the actual cost?
Chair Anderson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt. We want to be sensitive to concerns that the Department of Revenue has, and hoping that they set up their own fee schedule, and so we have transparency on that fee piece of it, too. So just giving the department some flexibility.
Lead Marquardt.
Final question, thank you, Mr. Chair, is typically, what type of businesses tend to ask for a private letter ruling? Is it larger businesses, smaller businesses? In my mind, I don't know enough about this, but I would think it would be more complex, maybe larger businesses. Have you got a sense of that or what that might be nationwide?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mark Bart, it can certainly vary. We see a lot of large corporate taxpayers request private law rulings, but also small businesses may request them. If they're looking for clarity on a sales tax issue, for example, in their particular industry, how an item might be either taxable or exempt. And certainly individuals facing a significant individual income tax question could also request a private letter ruling. So it does vary.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for members, to the supporters, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to, for my own clarification, I do also understand the complexities of the tax laws and so forth out there. And it does seem like when an entity or an individual has asked of the department, who is supposed to know, and get a kind of ruling as to where and what they ought to be doing, that they should be able to rely on that and not have consequences later into the future. And I also understand that there are errors made. We're all individuals that can make mistakes. And so when something does change in that determination or whatever, it seems realistic that ought to be from going forward and not be retroactive. My just question is, in regards to that, if there is a private letter ruling, this bill doesn't preclude that from being changed into the future by another interpretation or something, does it? Or am I mistaken there?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I understand the question, a private letter ruling that the department would issue is binding on that one taxpayer that requested it. But it certainly could be later revoked or changed at a later time, depending on case law or other guidance that came out. And certainly the department would want to update taxpayers on that if their position did happen to change.
Petersburg? You know, several members have said taxes are so complicated. I'd have to disagree, because if I have a question on taxes, I just call Mr. Michael. Okay, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to comment, Representative Marquardt. This happens a lot in construction-related industries. For example, you can go to a ready-mix plant and pick up a trailer there and buy the concrete and deliver it yourself. For many years, because the concrete was taxable but the delivery was separated out as being separate, then suddenly there was a ruling change that it's not ready-mix without the delivery. Another example is with regard to building the foundations. If the mason provided the material and block, then it was looked at as maybe the entire cost of the foundation was taxable, including the labor. Whereas if I have the credit lines and I buy the block directly and have them shipped to the job site, then the only tax is paid on the material, and I pay a separate bill to the mason that lays all the block. And this is a complicated arena, because after the fact and with some of these rulings, suddenly a project that you bid out at a certain cost suddenly has all sorts of overruns because of tax implications. So clarity in these letters would certainly help in that arena as well.
Questions for members? Okay, let's go to the department. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Let's go to the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jenny Starr, Assistant Commissioner for Business Taxes at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I hope you'll just let me get my presentation up here for you.
Whatever you need. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, we lost it. Now, I think being handed to you are the PowerPoint slides, so I'm going to get started without them and hope that it will come up here soon. One of the sort of things that I think is important as you're considering the implications of this bill is to understand the kinds of programs and services that the department currently provides under existing laws and how this bill would impact those current services. So I hope you have slides in front of you.
And members, we should have them dated 3/14/17, is that correct? Assistant Commissioner Starr. Oh, here we're up.
Yes. Okay, here we go.
Here we go.
All right. So one of the things that the Department of Revenue is particularly interested in is making sure that we provide customers with the information and education they need to meet their obligations under law. And we work on programs that reach a broad audience on complex topics and that efficiently use our resources. Under current law, customers can rely on all written guidance to abate penalties. And so I'm just going to take you through a little tour of the kinds of written guidance that the department currently offers and show you how they compare to private letter ruling programs out of other states. Our first stop are Minnesota fact sheets. So we've published over 160 fact sheets on our website. They cover all kinds of topic areas from the dry cleaner fee to credits for military personnel, petroleum taxes for farmers, and there are 80 fact sheets on sales and use tax alone, including this one that you see here in the image. It's just the very top of a six-page long fact sheet on hotels and lodging facilities. It answers a number of questions that we get from these kinds of retailers, and this fact sheet strives to provide the information and education they need on those complex topics. We keep this fact sheet up to date under current law, and we also make changes to it when we notice changes in industry practice. You'll see in the yellow banner what's new in 2015. There have been changes in the industry when it comes to complementary services versus package deals, and this fact sheet was updated to reflect that change. Now, here is a portion of a private letter ruling out of the state of California. It's just a few lines from a four-page long private letter ruling.
I believe it's Colorado.
Colorado. Oh, sorry. What did I say?
California.
Sorry, Colorado.
I'll pass.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You'll see this requester asked a number of questions about sales and use tax laws in hotel and lodging facilities, and one of those is highlighted in yellow, the no-show fee. And here is a portion of that fact sheet that I referenced earlier. Again, in yellow, you'll see the Department of Revenue's answer under Minnesota current law with regard to no-show fees. So we're really trying in these fact sheets to provide broadly applicable guidance that all can rely on, and that's free for everybody on our website, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The next step is industry guides. On sales and use tax in particular, there's statutes, rules. There are, as I said, over 60 fact sheets, and we know for some of our industries, it's hard to keep all of that information together. So we started making these industry guides on our website as a way to collect all of that information in one place. And we have a number of them. They range on topics from nonprofits to photography services. This one is a page, an image from the nonprofit industry guide. And what it's doing is helping people answer the question, is my nonprofit eligible for exempt status on my purchases? Here's a private letter ruling from the state of Kansas. Now, this one's a lot shorter than the previous one. It's only one page long. The requester is a nonprofit youth baseball organization, and they're asking the state of Kansas if they're exempt for purchases under Kansas's sales tax laws. And there's really only one sentence in this letter that's important. It says, no, you're not eligible. If you use our industry guide, you'll find your way to our application for nonprofit exempt status. And in that application, as you see here next to the yellow arrow, you'll find direction. That youth baseball organization would find direction and what documents they need to provide under Minnesota law to the Department of Revenue so that we can provide you with your exempt status for sales tax. Well, there's been quite a lot of talk here today about revenue notices, and so I want to chat with you a bit about revenue notices. Revenue notices are provided by Minnesota Statutes 270C07. They describe factual scenarios and explain how the department applies existing law to those facts. They're officially published in the State Register, and then they are published on our website. You can see them here.
We keep them in chronological order according to publication date, but you can also sort them by tax type. Revenue notices are a public form of binding guidance, which means all of our customers can rely on them. They bind the department with regard to all customers. And like all of our other written guidance, we update our revenue notices for law changes. We also update these when we notice changes in industry. Now, here's a portion of one revenue notice on a very complex question of corporate income tax law. This revenue notice addresses tiered partnerships and the kinds of complex questions that arise under organizational structures where a C corporation is a partner in a partnership and often a partner in multiple related entities. This revenue notice is straightforward. It's one page long. It explains two ways in which partnership income is included in a corporate partner's Minnesota income. This is a portion of a seven-page private letter ruling out of the state of Illinois. You'll notice it's published in redacted form, so you see a lot of Company B, Company A, Partnership 1, Partnership 2, X's taking out other private data about this taxpayer. This is fact-intensive, and it involves the apportionment calculation for a corporate taxpayer that has interest in both unitary and non-unitary partnerships. The ruling concludes that with respect to this taxpayer, the correct outcome is that apportionment should be determined on a collective basis for the unitary partnership, and that collective treatment should not be allowed for the non-unitary partnership. Like all private letter rulings that we've looked at, this one is only binding for one taxpayer on the Department of Revenue for one taxpayer, the taxpayer who requested it. Now, this is back to our revenue notice 0803. It advises all corporate taxpayers that they are required to calculate the apportionment percentage of unitary partnerships on a combined basis and are required to apportion income of a non-unitary partnership separately. This was originally published in 1992, which is prior to that Illinois private letter ruling I showed you, and it was updated in 2008. It addresses this complex area of law broadly, in a broadly applicable way, for all of our customers to rely on. Now, of course, we do get questions from people over email and through letter that are, right, they may be struggling to find what they need on their website, they're not sure where to look. We answer over 40,000 email questions in our sales, income, and withholding divisions alone on an annual basis. We respond to people in about 2 or 3 days. This is a question that we received about a difficult area of the law when it comes to customized computer software. You'll see in the bulleted list, which is just partially shown here, that this customer is asking us a number of questions. Now, here's a private letter ruling out of Utah. My recollection is this is about 4 pages long, and it asks very similar questions about customized computer software. This is just our email answer, and you see it's just the way, you know, one would expect an email to be. We highlighted our answers in red so that the person asking the question could easily follow along. And we frequently, when we answer these emails, try to point folks in the direction of our website, because we often have same or similar information available there. In fact, here is a Minnesota industry guide, again, addressing the issue of customized computer software. And I want you to know that I've told you this committee before, and I stand by it. The Department of Revenue is always interested in ways in which we can enhance our guidance program. We feel pretty strongly that today, with the guidance programs that we have, we're meeting our mission. We're reaching a broad audience in an efficient way with our useful resources covering complex topics. We provide many sources of guidance that can be relied on under today's laws to abate penalties. And those revenue notices in particular are binding on the department for all taxpayers, meaning the department cannot assess additional tax contrary to a position expressed in a revenue notice. It's this kind of robust, publicly available information that led to a result I spoke to the last time I was here
regarding Avalara, which is a company that supports retailers in their sales tax across all 50 states. And they named our website as the best sales and use tax website in the country because these publicly available guidance programs make it very easy to find an answer. In contrast, as you can see here, private letter rulings meet the needs of one taxpayer who can afford the cost of personal guidance at one point in time. Now, you've heard, of course, that 48 states offer a private letter ruling program, and I just want to take a few minutes to speak to that. Because as testifiers prior to me mentioned, not all programs in all states are the same. And I'll just highlight a few. California, for example, has a program that is similar in many ways to Minnesota's Revenue Notice program. They have public guidance that they publish that can be relied on by all. One difference is that California, in their public ruling program, only covers individual and business income tax. So unlike Minnesota, California will not answer questions in that public program with regards to sales and use tax. They don't issue very many of these. They published one in 2016, two in 2015. None were published, for example, in 2013. They do have a private program as well, but they do not publish those for the public to see, even in redacted form. Now, in the light blue, we have a number of other states. They do have a rulings program, but what I want you to know is they run those programs through their Administrative Procedures Act. So they're not necessarily the robust kind of program that is available through the federal government. And they just strike a different balance in some ways to what Minnesota's system has designed. For example, in some of these states, answers through the Administrative Procedures Act are appealable to an administrative court. Here in Minnesota, we have a dedicated tax court. We have direct appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court, which is extraordinary. But to strike a balance with those, the tax court and the Supreme Court opportunities, our laws require that you have a determination through audit or a determination on a claim for refund before you access the court systems. Our guidance program has similarly charted a different route. We focus on robustly publishing public guidance that's kept up to date with law changes and is available for all. Now, with all that said, are there enhancements that we could do now with our public guidance programs? The answer is absolutely yes. And we've convened listening sessions with our business tax professional counterparts, and we absolutely want to hear where our programs can be further improved. And one thing we heard in December when we convened a listening session, and you have a handout about that listening session today, we absolutely heard the need to provide more revenue notices on complex topics, and rightly so. As you can see here, back in 2002, we issued over 20 revenue notices, and in 2014, our publication dropped down to two. I'm glad to report to you that we are on the increase here. In 2016, we published eight. And after listening to our business tax professional partners, we've committed ourselves to publishing more in 2017 than we did in 2016. And of course, we've also heard from people that sometimes our revenue notices feel incomplete. They might answer one area, but there is another equally important question that should also be answered. And to respond to that, this year we have started sharing drafts of our revenue notices with the Minnesota State Bar Association, and we will begin doing so as well with the CPAs to make sure that we can hear feedback on areas where maybe the revenue notice we plan to publish is incomplete, and we could correct for that kind of feedback before we publish. We hope that these kinds of enhancements will meet the needs of even those with the most complex questions. I just want to note, I heard here today, right, one area of complex law is the difference between tangible personal property and real property in sales tax. We find that to be a complicated area of law as well. And in fact, we've recently had a couple of teleconferences with industry and with tax professionals on that question, and we're working on guidance in that area right now. Now, of course, even with all of our public guidance programs, it is true the Department of Revenue does not answer truly novel, unique questions that often come up in transactional tax planning. It's true. We don't provide that with the public guidance programs we have today. But I'll also offer this to you. It's also true that folks in those situations who have complex transactional planning needs, they don't ask a robust program like the Federal Private Letter Ruling Program for an answer unless they've worked with high-quality tax professionals and they're very certain of the answer they expect from the IRS. And I think it's important to note that here in Minnesota, we have excellent tax professionals who are prepared to help our customers with those unique tax planning needs. It's also the case, if you read about the federal program as an example of a robust private letter ruling program, that some will comment that if more time and care were spent on guidance that largely benefited all, it would be an improvement to the federal system versus providing limited scope certainty to a few. Now, I just briefly touch on some of the other portions of the bill, particularly talking about audit quality. So beyond our work to provide readily accessible, useful information, we're also dedicated to upholding high standards in our audit program. And I've spoken here before, in particular, about the quality assurance program we run in our sales and use tax division and about the surveys that we send to our customers at the close of our audits in that division. And here are just, I think in years past, I've showed you 1 year at a time the results of those surveys. And here you'll see the results over the past 3 years. Important to me is that 95% of our sales and use tax customers in audit have reported over the past 3 years that the auditor treated them fairly. We think this is a good sign that what we're doing in our audit program is meeting our high standards. When we look at Section 2, particularly in the bill regarding dual examination, we're concerned that we wouldn't be able to meet these high standards. We think that Section 2 would likely result in longer audit timelines, more intensive document requests, more time spent at a business location, multiple auditors interacting with the same customer at the same time. And this is going in the opposite direction of the feedback we hear from our customers in the kind of audit quality survey we do today. Different types of taxes require different lengths of time for audit. Complex corporate questions take longer than sales tax audits of the same types of businesses. We feel Section 2 would unnecessarily extend the time for those kinds of audits that could be done more efficiently. Statutes of limitations are different due to different filing requirements. Some sales tax customers file on a monthly basis, and then they file their corporate income tax return on an annual basis. We're concerned that under Section 2, we would be seeking more waivers for extensions of statute of limitations to sync up the time frames, and that's the opposite of what we hear from our customers, who are asking us to utilize those waivers less often and to get our work done on time. We also spend our audit time at different locations for different kinds of tax types. Corporate income tax records could be in New York. Sales and use tax records could be in Minnesota. Section 2 would be putting us in people's places of business in multiple locations, which is the opposite of what we hear from our customers who want us to use their time in their offices efficiently. We're also concerned about Section 3. Section 3 limits the sales tax audits, as you've heard. I'll give you an example here about, I want to talk to you a little bit about sampling. Okay? In sales and use tax, there's only one line on the return for the general state sales tax. When we look at a sales tax return, the scope of audit coverage is every taxable transaction that occurred in the audit period. That could be thousands upon thousands of transactional lines for a particular business. And we use sampling methods to make our time with that business more efficient. So just as an example, if you consider a store that sells food, electronics, clothing, they have thousands of products for sale, they use a tax matrix to assign each product code as taxable or exempt under Minnesota law. During the audit period, this retailer mistakenly coded honey roasted nuts as food and sold them exempt from tax. And at the time, based on our sampling methods, we didn't pick up any line, any transaction for honey roasted nuts. Years pass, new products are introduced, retailer checks out fact sheet 102B on candy for other items that they're introducing, but they don't notice that honey roasted nuts are taxable and are listed as taxable on that fact sheet. Years later, we come back for audit, and this time the sampling picks up those honey roasted nuts. Under this bill, Section 3, we could not assess for those taxable transactions, and this retailer would achieve an unfair advantage over its competitors for the same time period. I haven't shared these statistics before, but you should know that on our annual survey, 93% of our respondents in sales and use tax tell us that a sample was conducted during the course of their audit, and 94% report that they understood how the sample period was chosen and how it worked and what the findings were. In Sections 4 and 6, there are also concerns, and I'll just move through these very quickly. It establishes a reasonable cause grounds for reducing or eliminating an assessment of tax, and it ties reasonable cause to something that is a lack of clarity under the statute. This proposal we see as highly inconsistent with other state laws and federal law. Reasonable cause is often a statutory standard for abating penalties, but we are not aware of any jurisdiction where reasonable cause tied to lack of clarity is a basis for tax abatement or an assessment limitation. We anticipate significant litigation in this area. With all that said, I want to acknowledge that we hear from your constituents. Reflecting back on the business listening tax session, and we know that there are always ways for us to be improving our service, and we've already taken some steps in that direction, further steps in that direction, including things on this screen. I'll just highlight one, that audit quality survey that we use in sales and use tax, we've just expanded to our corporate audits, and I believe the first of those surveys just went out the last few days. Lastly, I'll just comment a little about fairness in Sections 5 and 8. We are concerned about the change in penalties under Section 5 and 8. Penalties today work to ensure that everybody report files and pays on time. And it treats people who file and pay on time differently than those who file and pay late. Eliminating all penalties of less than $150 and penalties less than $1,000 in certain circumstances will unfairly treat those who file and pay late the same as those who file and pay on time. Section 5 also gives extensive direct discretion to the commissioner on whether to impose or not impose a penalty. We anticipate this is difficult to implement and could result in substantial litigation. Also, it could give the false impression to the public that some have the ability to have their penalties abated while others do not. Now, current law does already provide for a first-time abatement, and here I draw you back to a revenue notice that's been in existence since 1997. You'll see just a portion of it here. We have a program that identifies those who filed or paid late for the first time and otherwise have a filing and paying history that is accurate under law and complies with our laws. We have in current years been able to automate for a large part the first-time abatement program, meaning penalties are abated automatically in our systems as returns and payments are processed. We abate about $2 million in penalties automatically under current law's reasonable cost standard. And, of course, other abatements occur at the request of taxpayers. And this revenue notice ensures that there is fairness and understanding across taxpayers
of how we apply the law consistently for all. I really appreciate your time, and I just have like two more things to say. Okay. Finally, I just want to touch briefly on Section 7 and the removal of current law's one-year time limit to claim a refund from the date the tax was assessed and the reversion back to law that was in place prior to 1996, which allows refunds for up to 2 years after tax was paid. Now, the problem with pre-1996 law was that the period for claiming a refund never expired for taxpayers who did not pay. So you could be assessed tax, and the statute of limitations would lapse on the assessment itself, but would never lapse on a claim for refund, wouldn't begin to lapse until you paid. So there's an incentive here not to pay. Statute of limitations, among other things, are intended to eliminate stale claims and provide finality, not only for the taxpayer, but for the state. So we are concerned, under Section 7 in particular, that this would put particular pressure on the department to receive payment as soon as possible so that finality and closure for the taxable period would occur. And to manage this, our collection divisions would likely need to expedite collection action so on things that are not paid. So they would be utilizing tools and processes like state tax liens, wage and bank levies, revoking professional licenses, more quickly in the process than we do today, in order to get finality under the statute of limitations. In sum, the department is committed to our vision, our mission of working together to fund Minnesota's future, and it's in that spirit that we engage in listening with our customers and that we make changes to the programs and services that we provide with that feedback in mind. This bill, if implemented, we feel would have a number of negative impacts. Specialized guidance only for those who can afford it, increasing the burdens of audit both for the department and taxpayers, and creating inconsistencies and inequities and litigation risks. I really appreciate your time, and that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Okay, did you get all the time you need? You got everything in?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay, just a couple questions I have, and then we do have four sessions, so we do need to get out of here by noon. But with the honey roasted nuts issue,
yeah.
Okay, the way it was originally done, the department didn't catch it, so I mean, it's kind of their deal. I don't think there's any intent to defraud on my honey roasted nuts. But so why do they then get penalized? How far back can they go to get penalized? I mean, the department missed it. It's not the company's fault that the department missed it. How far back can they go, the department go, to collect tax on honey roasted nuts?
The general limitation period is 3.5 years. I'm just looking over at council to get the nod. So statute of limitations work for the benefit of creating finality for all. The department can go back 3.5 years to look for inaccuracies in the return.
Ms. Starr, if the department didn't catch it, then and there's some back tax owed, is there penalties on that also?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, penalties, generally speaking, might apply, but I want you to, you know, penalties are usually for late filing, late payment. This would not be, the scenario you're explaining wouldn't be a scenario of negligence or fraud. None of those penalties would apply.
And they weren't drinking. Okay, so Chair Anderson asks, do you have any information on how much is spent under the current system for businesses to litigate, for litigation costs? Are there any figures like that?
Yes, I've looked into it, and so what happens is the AG represents the Department of Revenue on these cases. For fiscal year 2016, Department of Revenue sent over
Between fiscal year 2016 and 2015, the Department of Revenue sent over $1.1 million. In fiscal year 2014, they sent over $387,000. So between the 3 years, it's over $1.5 million that was spent on litigation costs. Now, that doesn't include there's some additional spending that the AG's office does, and that ranges anywhere from $300,000 to $800,000. So that's what we're currently spending on litigation under how we operate today. But on top of that, what you're seeing is a trend in an uptick. From when you look at fiscal year 14, we increased it by another $200,000 for fiscal years 15 and 16. So we're seeing a trend going upward in our litigation costs under our system that we have here today. And Mr. Chair, just to, if I could, comment to some of the other things that Ms. Starr has mentioned. When you have the private letter rulings that are published online, this isn't just access to one individual. This is access to every taxpayer by having this information available to everybody to get some guidance from our Department of Revenue. And I think that's the goal here is helping our businesses to comply with the tax law that we have in place and understanding what is the interpretation. And as you highlighted with the honey roasted nuts, you know, right now the Department of Revenue says it's a 3.5 look back period, but the next Department of Revenue could say it's 7 years or something to that effect. We don't know. And so, you know, these are some things that we probably need to put in place to discuss, you know, what kind of penalty are we asking businesses to pay for something that they were just complying with what they thought was the right thing to do.
And that's a big concern of mine, too. I mean, so your business, you get audited, the auditor says this is the way it is, you comply with that, you get audited again, and somebody comes and says, no, that was wrong. And that really bothers me, because if the company's complying, you did it right, the deal's done, that the department come back and say, no, that wasn't quite right, now you got to pay this. I mean, that's just not very Minnesota nice, I would say. So let's do this. Let's go, well, we got to get going here. Representative Hertas, any other member questions? I think I understand the bill. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Anderson. What I hear from a lot of businesses that find themselves in this circumstance, they feel that the department allows us to continue to the maximum allowable duration of time. They claw back for the maximum of time as though it's not worth the effort to chase it until the amount becomes large enough. To the department or the chair, what history do you have in terms of data that shows that might be consistent, that always the maximum clawback is employed before a problem is detected?
Chair Anderson, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, I know that the people of the Department of Revenue are working hard, and I think that, you know, with this piece of legislation, that it will just bring transparency and clarity for everyone. I don't think it's their intent to do that. I think it's just this will give us a better opportunity to make sure that the businesses are complying with our tax law. And I think that's the goal for everybody. I'm certain that it's the goal of the Department of Revenue that we make sure that our businesses have the tools that they need to comply with our tax law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I would just reinforce the comment that I hear from businesses. They always ask, why did it take them 3 years to figure out that I wasn't doing it right? So, okay.
With that, members, we're going to have a wrap-up from the author of the bill, and then we will head to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I just ask for your support.
Okay, I will move that House, or Chair Anderson S. moves that House file number 1694 as amended later for possible inclusion of the omnibus tax bill. Ms. Starr, Department, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Anderson, and to the witnesses. Thank you, members, for your work today. We'll see you tomorrow, if not before. Good government all the time. We're adjourned.